Hello and welcome in again to another episode of the Data Center Frontier Show podcast. I'm Matt Vincent, Editor-in-Chief of Data Center Frontier, here with my counterpart, David Chernikoff, Senior Editor of Data Center Frontier. And we're here today with our guest, Jason Carolan. Jason is Chief Innovation Officer at Flexential, and we're thrilled to have him here. Thanks for joining us, Jason.
Thanks, Matt. Thanks, David. Happy to be here as well.
Great. Well, Jason is a 25-year expert in the enterprise IT industry, has experience leading companies through technological evolutions like the one we're experiencing right now in the data center industry with AI. And Jason, you reached out to us here at the DCF editorial desk because you saw our recent story about NVIDIA, you know, NVIDIA's earnings for Q4. And thought that there might be an opportunity to discuss larger trends that might follow from, that specific news and the sheer dollar amount of NVIDIA's valuation. So let's go into it, Jason. I mean, maybe you want to start out by telling us a little bit about yourself and your role at Flexential, who we love to cover.
Yeah, sounds good. It's been interesting to sort of watch the AI growth. I think I first programmed my first neural network back in probably the late 80s. So it's just sort of funny how long we've been kind of at this. I think the Dartmouth Conference was in the 50s, and then there's a bunch of science fiction beyond that. So it's just been fun to sort of see it evolve in a very exciting space, you know, to be in. A little bit on Flexential, we're a U.S.-focused data center and interconnect operator with 41 data centers across 19 markets. We also offer cloud and managed services in some of those locations, but have about 3,000 enterprise customers that we support every single day on their highly resilient workloads. And increasingly, those workloads are becoming AI workloads. So happy to be here to chat about it. It was interesting. I was talking to a couple other technology companies that are also quite large that had earnings announcements that week, and they're like, "Well, did you see ours?" I'm like, "No, I don't think anybody saw yours. They just saw NVIDIA." So it was pretty funny.
Yeah, well, I mean, you make the point that their earnings results and their forecasts. In fact, I think I made the point in the article. I mean, it's data centers know where they're getting those GPUs from. In bulk, but I had the sense that you wanted to uncover a bit more in terms of what we can expect with the accelerating AI rollouts in terms of what data centers, and particularly what have traditionally been thought of as colocation data centers, can expect going into the age of AI. I mean, I think it was anyway, I'll just leave it there and let you respond.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, it's all happening in parallel. And, cloud certainly is, continues to grow. But I was just at an event yesterday with AWS's AI chief. And, this is all happening in parallel, right? So it's increasingly going to be hard to separate, what is cloud versus perhaps what is net new AI workloads. From the chip perspective, I think it's, IDC data that points to, today we roughly have 10 CPUs for every one GPU. And by 2027, that looks more like five to one. So we can't forget about CPUs. And I think, as you see sort of diversification out there, different capabilities coming to market with ARM and different capabilities coming with AMD, that we'll continue to, see diversification, I think, just in that stack, because not all GPUs are going to be created equal, but there are some use cases where you don't need all the horsepower that perhaps NVIDIA is coming to the table with, and they know that because they have multiple form factors themselves. So the main thing that we see is just the thermal demand for both CPUs and GPUs, really doubles or triples depending on how you look at it in the course of those next 5 years. And so I think most of the data center operators out there are trying to scramble to be able to support that, and support things like liquid cooling and other technologies that help facilitate what are bigger and bigger workloads, again, in parallel with what's happening just on the growth of cloud, which will continue as well.
Understood. David, did you want to jump here in here with some thoughts and or a question?
Well, it's interesting that you bring up the range of GPU possibilities. What do you have any comment on the recent Cisco announcement with NVIDIA where they're partnering to deploy their Tensor cores, but not the full HGX of deployments, but deploy their Tensor core GPUs within the existing Cisco rack model, within their Blade servers, so they can just deploy it into potentially people who are already using Flex Central data centers everywhere. Let's go add a few of these to our rack or a few of these to our Cisco environment and move forward with that. Is that going to have a big impact on what Flex Central and other co-providers are doing?
Well, I think it's going to be a trend. It's either being included into, you look at the chip roadmaps from, really everybody, including Intel, AMD, and ARM. And they're all including, either it's, further enhancing their crypto capabilities, crypto math capabilities, essentially, or, finding ways to incorporate more ASIC level or FPGA level, services, which are much more efficient, which is, goes back to Tensor. Tensor is fairly simple when it comes to, great for inference, great for front-end processing, which, a lot of these systems are essentially network computers anyway, and that's what they do, versus what horsepower you need to go do large, language model training, which is almost a completely different architecture in terms of how you deploy that. So it's definitely, two different use cases. And I think enterprises, just in from my speaking with them, one, they're going to license a large LLM just because the innovation's really happening with Anthropic and Meta and AWS and OpenAI and Microsoft, and having access to the data scientists that can even do that work is really, really tough. So I think for the most part, you're either going to see enterprises, essentially licensing and integrating to one of those stacks or many of those stacks, because each of the large language models all have slightly different capabilities and look at the world slightly differently, whether it's, graphically or whether it's text and how latent, is the model and how is it retraining itself sort of on demand. But also I think just inference, which is really the key, the key use case at scale, but doesn't require quite as much horsepower as the large language models themselves. So I think that's the diversification as well, which is this, training versus inference. And the industry is so focused on training right now, which is where you see these, large, very large scale, 1,000, 2,000, 10,000, node deployments, which, are going to continue as well as we look at the roadmaps for a lot of these vendors. It's about getting bigger and bigger and bigger and more integrated, which, I think is a competitive advantage for NVIDIA, which I think we might touch on here in a bit.
Thank you for that. This is kind of a broad question, but in terms of possible limiting factors to AI rollouts, where does the chip supply issue, how does that compare to the power conundrum? Because I've heard other people say that, the chips could be a real limiting factor, but, how does that square up in your mind?
I was actually just able to meet with, the NVIDIA team just a couple of days ago. So I actually, asked the same question just on how they see the supply chain, dynamics. I think they, not to put words in their mouth, but I think they're feeling pretty confident, on the supply chain, on the chip side. I think where the rub is, it doesn't take much from a geopolitical, there's just so much happening in the world that disruption can kind of happen, anywhere at almost any time. So I think when you think about where raw materials have to come and how much, the chip manufacturing raw materials come in, they come to the United States in many cases, the wafer work might be done in the Middle East and those chips come back for QA, but they also get assembled in Taiwan. And I mean, so there's a huge global supply chain that is all transport, driven. So when you have transport, issues in areas of the world that have conflict, that can go disrupt things for sure. The power supply chain issues, it feels like we're at a mode where if you can get power in a region and continue to build there, you're going to be out of power again in 2 to 3 years. And I think we're seeing that in markets really across the United States. So it's you can solve for the immediate generation, transmission, distribution, but the supply chain is so constrained that you're not really able to go purchase far enough in advance and try to guarantee slots just because the demand is so high. So it's, I can see it sort of cyclical. You'll be able to go build in a region for a couple of years. It's going to be out of power. You know, it could take another 3 to 4 years to be able to get that back online and more generation back online. And then you can continue the, you know, the build outs, which I think is just going to drive continued, you know, just tier end markets in the United States and, you know, really going where the power is, which is, I call the new denominator versus the network, because you used to be able to go, you know, you built where the network was and you would assume you had power. Now it's really the opposite.
Well, that's a great insight. So you said that you've been talking to NVIDIA. You note that the company is, you know, NVIDIA is forecasted to ship 4 to 5 times more GPUs this coming year. I mean, and that indicates a trend line with little competition in sight. I mean, do you really see a competitor for at this moment in the market for NVIDIA at the level that they, you know, that they are supplying the GPUs to the industry? I mean, you know, we could, not to make too simple a question, but I mean, do they have competition at this moment in time? I mean, I know they have competition, but I think you see what I'm saying. Yeah. I mean,
yeah, I see what you're saying. I mean, it's very interesting because it's they have very different thought philosophies on how they holistically integrate the most high performant platform that they can. And I think that is their competitive advantage. Now, I was just trying to think of a good analogy this morning, and, you know, kind of an airplane buff, and, you know, the F-35 is a pretty high performing aircraft that has highly integrated technology all the way into the cockpit to the helmet, you know, so the user interfaces are designed, you know, for very much, you know, the most high performant, you know, platform that's probably ever been launched, you know, from, you know, the airline manufacturers and the weapons companies. So I think, you know, very similar analogy, which is their value is really their full stack. And the hyperscalers kind of have their full stacks. But from a hardware perspective, they have typically oriented themselves around, you know, cost efficiency and sort of scale out, where I think NVIDIA is highly vertically integrated. You know, the acquisition they made of Mellanox, you know, 4 years ago or whatever the number is significant in making this work, right? Because, you know, there's some statistics on cabling inside of like CoreWeave's infrastructure, and they're a partner of ours as well. You know, their ML Perf cluster had almost 500 miles of fiber cable, and you just think about the density of that, and it wouldn't be possible if Mellanox wasn't part of the equation, and it wouldn't be possible if CUDA wasn't part of the equation, the software stack. So I think that's the competitive advantage, but also being able to do it at continued, just, you know, crazy scale. And I don't think there's really a competitor in sight, you know, at least on in any you know, current state. Now, that being said, there's up and comers like Samba Systems and Cerebras and others that, you know, have slightly different ways that they're looking at the problem, but I feel like these guys are so far ahead that it's going to be a little while, I think.
Yep. David, did you want to get in here on this topic that we're talking about right now with the competitor?
Well, you actually got to what was going to be my question as you wrapped that up. How much of an advantage do you think that the embedded ranks of CUDA developers is responsible for just keeping NVIDIA on top? I mean, I've been developing in CUDA for 10 years. Why should I move to something else, right?
Oh, it's huge. Yeah. I mean, if you can lock in the developer, it's really hard to change. I mean, you see that every day with, you know, cloud, right? And, you know, if you can't find, it's really hard to just go replatform systems without having the developer as part of the equation, right? And it happens all the time where a customer, you know, is thinking they're going to go move all these workloads to AWS, and they get stuck because the developers, you know, can't support the new app. They can't, you know, see the code anymore. And so I think it's a huge thing. And it's a huge, again, you know, that interface and that integration, you know, from a high performance compute, you know, grid computing is what we called it in my days at Sun.
Back in the day, you know, yeah.
It's a huge competitive advantage for sure. Yeah.
Jason, I wanted to ask you about, AI and the role of edge data centers. Is the edge like what is the thinking for a co-location data center operator like yourself that's playing in AI? Is there this consideration for edge type of compute factor in much for you, or is the question off base? Is that just a different school of thought for implementing AI?
Great question, and one that, you know, is, I think, can be confusing at times, because edge is relevant, right? And some people might call, you know, a data center in the middle of Iowa to be edge because it's near the eyeball networks in Iowa versus it's not in DC or in San Jose. But I think as I really believe the next generation of AI innovation is going to be around IoT. And, you know, the large language models have been really focused on structured data. And the real opportunity is just dealing with the growth of unstructured data, which I think is only going to, you know, quadruple, double, triple to yottabytes, you know, in the course of the next decade. And I think that is the advantage of why you need to start moving resources much more closer to, you know, wherever the manufacturing, the logistics. You know, we have one customer that, you know, they have trucks that drive across the United States, and they're trying to get consistent logistics all the time from logistics telemetry from them all the time as they go. They'll want it routed to their nearest data center, you know, as they go from, you know, east to west or west to east. And that's, you know, something you see with the train systems, with positive train control, something you see with video a lot. So I think we're going to continue to see the edge deployments that we probably first started talking about, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, maybe in the mode of mobile edge compute. But I'd still say early days and all that, but continue to see the diversification of workloads.
I've brought up industrial IoT, edge, and AI with a couple of people in the past. And the consensus response I seem to get is, it's not going to be the next market because it's too vertical. There are too many specialized devices in that space that a general purpose AI type model is not going to work there. Now, obviously Qualcomm disagrees because they want to tell you every phone they make, every right. device at that level is an AI device. So how do you think that's going to work itself out?
I think it's just, we probably wouldn't have said we'd be using AI the way we're using it today, you know, either. Right. And I think it's just narrow, you know, we're learning as we go, but, you know, the unstructured data growth, you know, needs a solution. And if you can start to collaborate, you know, think about sustainability and energy, right? So we were talking about power. And how power is the grand constraint. Well, you know, it's also climate change and climate impact and, you know, all of that, right? So it's ultimately, you know, coming up with consistent, you know, data models and probably working together to go solve these types of things, which, you know, you'll start to see specialized large language models that can support, you know, maybe it's just trying to go grab climate data and sustainability data and do correlation, you know, of how is weather affecting my data center, right? I mean, it's sort of funny. You know, 30, 40 years ago, you know, we didn't have 100 degree temperatures in Oregon, right? I mean, and so you design data centers, you know, for a different temperature profile. And now we're seeing that, you know, grow 10 to 20%, you know, percent. And so having IoT and being able to understand those use cases, I think it's just it's a matter of time. And I think, you know, certainly the hyperscalers agree on that. And, you know, again, just it's early days.
Jason, another question that appears to be kind of off the beaten track, but I think it factors in is, and I just want to ask you this question too, because of your role. You know, we write a lot about the data center industry confronting its PR problems. And obviously now we're in this age of, you know, this new age of data centers where, you know, there's a lot of anticipation for even greater expansion with going along with AI. Do you have any particular thoughts about that as the CIO of, you know, a major data center operator like Flexential? I mean, this as you're moving into, you know, new locations and evaluating expansions and stuff, you know, I was at DCD last November, and you know, a big point was made from the podium about how you know, the data center industry needs to be telling its story in a more effective way, but also you know, hearing other voices who are hearing from other voices who are you know, along with the data center industry on the journey. You know, is there any insight or light you could shed onto this this issue that the industry faces in terms of getting ahead of backlash for data center expansion?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question, and probably a whole bunch of different facets there. But, you know, one, having, you know, an ESG strategy that, you know, is community oriented and can be able to engage with the community at the right levels is important. I think there's, you know, design elements, you know, that can help, you know, reduce the local impact. There's certainly, you know, how you look at, you know, clean energy, as we've touched on, and, you know, generation. You know, ultimately, the noise that's produced by a data center is when the generators are mostly on. So, you know, being able to redesign those so that it's not as impactful, or perhaps using, you know, different energy sources, you know, even battery storage, you know, is an element of trying to reduce that impact. I think a lot of you know, we work with jurisdictions for, you know, whether it's tax programs, whether it's, you know, the state in terms of its strategy, you know, and there's definitely, you know, like anything, there's kind of the YIMBY, there's a YIMBY NIMBY, you know, thing, right? And it's, I think the only way I could say solving for it is working with, you know, the local region, working with the development organizations in those regions, and really just trying to take it head on, rather than trying to, you know, be behind it and then have to go pause a project because it's not going to work out. And I would say that's, you know, same with the power companies. It's, you know, it's early engagement. It's understanding, you know, their load, their capacity, where their roadmap is, and it's 3 to 4 years out. So I think it's just early engagement, working with the partners, helping them understand what the ecosystem looks like. You know, as an example, you look at Ohio, you know, which has been a AWS, you know, node for a while, and you know, now we've got Intel, you know, coming on board with its chip manufacturing there. You've got an EV plant there. I mean, so it starts to create a flywheel effect of bringing jobs to the region. You know, a data center itself, you know, doesn't employ a ton of people, but man, the ecosystem around it absolutely does, and I think that's a big piece of it too.
Thank you for going down that road with me there, because I felt like I had to ask you that. But let's reel it back to NVIDIA and AI. David, this is your big chance to, as we you know, close down, get to the end of our time here. Is there anything else, David, that we're not asking of Jason here as Chief Innovation Officer at Flexential that we should be asking of him on the topic of NVIDIA and the AI boom?
As you plan for future expansion of Flexential, how much do you have to take into consideration things like those prepackaged HGX 100 servers, you know, the GGX products, where the clients are going to come to you and say, I'm going to invest this money in this hugely power intensive prepackaged server from NVIDIA, and I want to stick it in your data centers?
Yeah, great question. And certainly top of mind to be able to support power density, you know, at greater and greater rates. And, you know, we have liquid cooling projects today. You know, it's, you know, liquid is probably the only way to get around this. I think the initial use cases are going to be a mixture of air and liquid. And, you know, we're seeing immersion, but probably not, you know, immersion at the, you know, at the blade level, but more to direct to chip or cold plate, you know, being probably the most popular, just because it's a little bit easier to control. It doesn't quite require the same pressure. You know, which is important when you're thinking about mixed workloads. You know, you've got liquid in one area and not liquid in another, and you've got mixed workloads sort of sitting together in these multi-tenant facilities. So being able to design safely how everybody can kind of coexist together is top of mind, you know, for sure. I think from an enterprise deployment perspective, you know, it's going to be two major models. One would be if they're very interested in creating their own language models. They're going to invest in, you know, more of a rack, you know, level architecture that's highly dense and, you know, could weigh thousands of pounds when you think about Liquid and you know, requires maybe 100 to 150 kilowatts of power and cooling. I think other enterprises are going to be able to you know, take one of those HGXs or, you know, slide them into their existing environment. There's enough, you know, probably capacity there to support, you know, a few of those mixed together, especially around inference and being able to go support, you know, data access and being a local data, you know, data repository, which needs, you know, inference needs a lot more data access than large language models, which is almost, you know, something that's slightly reversed from what you would think. So the large language models are somewhat fixed in what they need for data. Inference is building, you know, new data all the time. So it needs a place to go store that. So I think it's very much mixed mode, you know, for a while. I get to run our advisory council too. So I've had the conversations with, you know, our customers, the top 25, and, you know, it's a slow, you know, while we talk a lot about 100 kilowatt racks, you know, the growth is somewhat, when you average it across the industry has millions of racks, it just starts to, you know, it's more of a, maybe it's a kilowatt a year kind of average, right? So you got to think about this just from a time horizon that we're supporting mixed workloads, and we'll continue to support that as use cases continue to develop.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, that was really going to be, you know, one of the big questions that I should have been asking is that you kind of just addressed it with the mixture of air and liquid cooling. But, you know, somebody last year at a show said to me, I asked, you know, when I was, you know, I asked them, you know, when we're supposed to be at the AI inflection point, when will we be at the liquid cooling inflection point? And he said, we're at it right now. And yet, it seems to me that when I ask most, you know, particularly, you know, it's mostly at this point, colo providers who I talk to, they tell me, you know, we have it in certain data centers, we're building it in where it makes sense, you know, across our footprint. I mean, can you ever envision a time when, you know, we'll be, this is a terrible question, but I mean, can you envision a fully liquid cooled data center? Maybe one exists out there somewhere. Or do you think that with the mixed workloads, we can expect for, you know, the foreseeable future, seeing with large data center operators, you know, the combination of both? I mean, it's
I know of some 100% liquid immersion deployments, but they're, you know, they're essentially edge facilities, right? I wouldn't call them, you know, a data center of any scale. And those do exist, and there are specific use cases and why you do it. I think the challenge is we don't really have maintenance and operating models for this at scale. And, you know, if you're thinking about, you know, you could have, you know, 300 to 400 degrees Fahrenheit, you know, water or liquid or dielectric fluid, you know, sitting in an environment that somebody needs to, you know, be able to maintain, right? And I think that's, you know, it's scary because we don't have those maintenance models. So I think that slows things down. I think it's a concern for, you know, some of the chip companies on how do we go maintain this safely and go create the right models at scale that, you know, makes it easier. And, you know, the standards are still evolving and not really, you know, super solid. So, you know, we're very much focused on liquid, but it's what does liquid mean to you is a whole other thing. So being able to bring it in, being able to cool it, being able to secure it, being able to, you know, have a supply and still be very positive on how we look at WUE and things like that. That's what we're focused on, and just being as open as we can be and really collaborating with what that design might look like, because of the liquid engagements we have today all look a little bit different.
Do you see Flexential or are your competitors offering cooling upgrades basically in a staged manner, like perhaps start off with rear door heat exchangers, then rear door heat exchangers with liquid, then direct to chip, and just so that, but on a per hall basis, not necessarily a per rack basis, but let's not make it too complicated to have in a specific hall to have three different kinds of cooling, but maybe this hall gets solution A, next hall gets solution B, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think, you know, the data center provider is going to have SKUs for a lot of this and be able to support it. You know, it's also a great way to go into a retrofit, you know, situation. And we talk a lot about, the carrier hotels that are all, you know, they're pretty old. And, you know, what do you think about the capacity in there? And some may have a lot of power, but can't cool because they're in, you know, really old buildings. So I think being able to go create a diversified portfolio that can solve for those different types of things is the key.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Jason, for those answers. You really, you know, shed a lot of light for us today in this discussion. Thanks for joining us here at Data Center Frontier.
Thanks, Matt. Thanks, David.